Here is one of a series of talks by spiritual leader Lola McDowell Lee, spanning two decades from the early 70s through the 90s. Lola was a Zen Roshi, whose Rinzai lineage included Dr. Henry Plutov and renowned Zen master Shigetsu Sasaki. Lola was a religious scholar as well as an ordained Christian minister. While the talks are focused mainly on Zen and Buddhism, Lola drew on many spiritual traditions, including those of Jesus, Plato, Lao Tzu, the Hindu Vedas, Meister Eckhart, and Gurdjieff.
There is an old saying, and I think it comes out of Zen, which goes, joy in the morning, sleep in the evening, what else? Well, one hears something like that perhaps for the first time, and one thinks it's kind of kooky. Joy in the morning and sleep in the evening, what else? Well, look at what else, my Lord. Look at all what else goes on in here with me. And if that's all life really was, why, how boring. I mean, we're very entertained by ourselves and our predicaments, you know. Makes the world go round. It's kind of like the man who went to the doctor and he was all doubled up with pain. So the doctor examined him and he says, well, you're going to have to give up the good life, you know, wine, women, and song. That's no more for you. And he's all doubled over with pain and saying, what's that got to do with it? And the doctor says, well, you're going to have to give up smoking too. And the man says, I feel like such a fool standing around doing nothing. So, with the joy in the morning and the sleep in the evening, what else? You feel like such a fool standing around doing nothing. Only you won't, if you really understand that. Because, you know, we also hear phrases like, how wondrous this, how mysterious. I carry water, I chop wood. Well, we would sort of like, in a way, to understand this, wouldn't we? How wondrous this, how mysterious. I get out of bed in the morning and I eat breakfast. I go out and I start the car. I go out and water the lawn. How wondrous. How mysterious. I can carry a cup of coffee. How mysterious this. So once one has this pointed out to them, you know, and then decides, well, maybe I would really like to understand what this is all about, what makes this so wondrous that I can walk out the door. So in our plodding around with this enigma, an enigma it is, we come finally in our searching around to a word which is no mind. Or sometimes people use the phrase mindfulness. They're Zen terms, huh? Mindfulness. What is mindfulness? Sounds a little better than no mind. Yeah? There was an educator, I'm sure you've heard of him, Professor Northrop, once said that the present world situation is not simply a battle between, say, like communism and capitalism, or between the Eastern way of thinking and the Western way of thinking, between East and West. It's simply the problem is between enlightenment and darkness. the enlightenment and the darkness in the individual mind. That's always where you look for anything, is your own mind. It is the individual mind where all the problems originate, be they personal or be they collective. Because when they're collective, it's a bunch of individual minds putting all their little things together and saying, well, they, you know. We operate, you know, with a thinking mind rather than a no mind. Hearing me for that, say that for the first time makes sense, doesn't it? Well, you know, I may have the best intentions in the world, but if I am not mindful, I am the victim of exploitation. That is, I fall under the influence of my own grasping. Now, nobody wants to be in this kind of a situation, huh? And I'm told that I can bring an end to all of this kind of thing by getting understanding. That is mindfulness. Because after all, mindfulness is understanding. If you understand mindful, you understand. In the meanwhile, you're only thinking about it, which is not being mindful. In the state of mindfulness, or no mind, I can no longer be exploited. And it isn't that then I have built up a whole lot of sales resistance to things. No, it just simply signifies the absence of a buyer. After all, who's buying all this stuff? Be the buyer, and even three aspects we look at with this. You know, the buyer may be looking for something material, something political, or something spiritual. Some kind of goods to buy. When there is no buyer present, so not wanting to be exploited either by myself. And isn't it where it all starts? Nobody can con you into anything if you're not there to be conned, if you're mindful enough. So not wanting to be exploited either by myself or by others, which I allow if it's others. Let me give you a for instance, a very personal for instance now here. The other day, I received in the mail an invitation, and it is called an invitation to distinction. The Heritage Institute has written to me asking me whether or not I would like to have an honorary doctorate degree. Now, if I say yes, who is being exploited? Who is allowing them to exploit me, if that's what it is? And it is. Me. Now, I can go ahead and say, okay, I know I'm being exploited, and go ahead and do it. But if I don't know I'm being exploited, I need to just buy the thing. I grab the thing in my teeth, you know. I am allowing them to exploit me, regardless of how they're exploiting me or who is exploiting me. You see the point? Well, some of you do. See, not wanting to be a buyer, not wanting to be exploited. And it's very important in your daily life that you see this. that how you are allowing others to manipulate you, because you're manipulating yourself first. So then, not wanting this to happen, and this allowing others to exploit you, you know, because you want to be exploited, covers a tremendous realm. I mean, really. Well, you can look back in your life and see all the things you've been into. Why did you go into them? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I don't want to be this way anymore, I think, because now I've heard that there is a different way of living. So then the first question that comes up is how? You know, how to get to a place of mindfulness so that I don't fall into the trap of exploiting myself. You know, it is really an incredible thought. I have all this while been exploiting myself. Horrible thing. How could such a thing have happened? Well, simply because in my grasping, I wasn't paying any attention. But anyway, mostly what we've done, because we haven't looked at the exploitation of ourselves, we begin to look around for somebody to give us some kind of a magic formula so that we can get out of the predicament that we're in, and not realizing we're exploiting ourselves again and putting ourselves in another predicament. And then we look around for another magic formula to get out of that. And so, you know, and this is, you know, how we join this political group, and then we join this kind of a church, and, you know, we go the whole gamut. And this is the thing we're doing all the time. We're selling ourselves. We begin to look at how am I going to be mindful so that I am no longer the buyer. How? Well, we go into this next thing, whatever it is, this how, and we look for something to put together with it, and we know how we have to learn other things, which is piecemeal, so we figure this how is going to be piecemeal also. It's like the fellow that was sentenced to a long, long jail term. Don't laugh already yet. Huh? I can tell if you laugh already yet. Anyway, he's sitting there in jail, and he realizes he's got this whole long stretch of years ahead of him, almost all his life. And, you know, he begins to feel sorry for himself, and his teeth begin to hurt. So he complains that his teeth hurt. And he complains so often and long enough, and even he has all these examinations in order to shut them up, they take his teeth out. And then after a while, it didn't really solve the problem, so then now he's got a throat. His throat bothers him. And more and more and more and more his throat bothers him. So finally they take out his tonsils. Well, and after another length of time, he's got a stomach ache. And finally, they take out his appendix. And after he's out of the prison hospital and they take him back to his cell, the guard turns around and looks at him, you know, and he says, you know, you're not fooling anybody, you know. You're only trying to get out of here piecemeal. See, I told you not to laugh. Well, yeah. You can't get freedom. You can't, you know, piecemeal. You practice at something, and all of a sudden you're free. But it is not something that you can really cultivate. I add a little piece here and add a little piece here and take away a piece here and take away a piece here, and now I'm going to be free. It doesn't work that way. Freedom you can't cut into pieces. You know. So to be mindful, to be free, to be liberated, you know, no mind. All of a sudden, it's there. So it's called spontaneous. Just like that, huh? Spontaneous. as soon as a right set of conditions comes about. So, we can talk a little bit about conditions. Now, first of all, and I say this very often, and I don't see it happening, if you can set aside the running commentary of the objective mind, if you can just ignore the moving parts of your mind, if you can just sort of hold it in abeyance for a little while, then I think each of us would come to the place where we would know what mindful is. See, some of you now are even lost in thought with all your moving parts, huh? And you know, I say it over and over and over and over again, and I probably will say it over and over and over and over again. You do have a running commentary. Shut it off. Turn off the faucet. You sit there and you say, well, maybe Lola's right and maybe she's not. Oh, yeah, she's right about this thing because I know from my own experience that that happened to me, so then she must be right. And she must be right because what she's saying fits in with what I believe. Or maybe this time she's not right because it doesn't fit with what I already know. And this concept now that she says now doesn't fit in with a concept that she said last Sunday or three Sundays ago, or I don't know that you remember that far back. But, you know, 5 minutes ago, maybe you remember, huh? See? You're dissecting all the time. You're looking at all the different little parts. Now, we could say, and we do say, that to have this running commentary going on all the time implies a state of not knowing. And we don't want anybody to know that we don't know, mostly ourselves, because nobody's listening to your thoughts anyway. But not knowing is something we want to cover up. You know, look at this objective consciousness of your mind. It always knows. How often do you say, I don't know? You get a thought in there, and yeah, I know. I know. Okay, what do you know? Do you even know this objective self-consciousness state that says, I know? Oh, no, but I know. Yeah? So then we could say, if all of this knowing is our objective self-consciousness, then maybe not knowing would be subjective. And I don't mean just to sit there and say the words. I mean to actually be a not knowing, to be it. And now this is a whole new thing. So we begin to explore this uncharted, unmarked, land or place of not knowing. And we do it with an attitude of an exciting adventure. There is nothing more exciting than exploring your own not knowing. And because we do not know, we do not care where it's going to lead. That's your exploitation. You want to know where it's going to lead you. But in the not knowing, we do not care what the outcome will be. How can you plot a not knowing? It's simply a state of not knowing, of no mind. It's mind with no moving parts to go astray. But by that, all the moving thoughts. Yeah? Well, in order to see what mindfulness is, or we could say now what not knowing is, or what no mind is, we can use these three terms interchangeably, huh? It might first be a little bit useful to see what it's not. Huh? And when you see what it's not, you will know why you cannot create this other thing of no mind. Now, we know that there are many ways being advocated today. You know, there are many, many groups. And they all say, you know, you do this and you do this and you do this and you will wind up here. You had a certain goal. And so you do this and you do this and you do this and you're not at that goal. So something's wrong somewhere. You're either walking around with a tremendous guilt because you haven't arrived at what they said you would arrive at, because you did exactly as they said, or you go out and find something else. So, and then you say, they exploited me. Yeah. And then you go ahead, but you know, and the thing is in there that you've always still got your own concept of what the goal should be spiritually, politically, materially. Now, uncritical people who do not question themselves, you know, uncritically, many, many people, they throw themselves at the mercy of some teacher or some group or something like that. And when it, as I said, and when they're disappointed enough, why then they go to another group and they go to another group and they're accumulating more parts to this mind. But I will say one thing, you know, you've got to start someplace. So they go through these things, and finally maybe they will reach a place, if they begin to be a little critical about themselves through all of this, they keep a searching and keep a searching and keep a searching until maybe they'll reach a place where they all of a sudden they hear about no mind. And they're either going to get up and stomp out, because whoever heard of such a thing, how boring, no mind, you know, I'll be a vegetable. But together with this no mind, you know, they are told you have to work things out for yourself. A moment does arise, and there have been many moments in your lives where you feel a need, or you should feel a need, to take stock of your search and of your present state of understanding, whatever your state of understanding is at this time. It needs some examination. It needs to be examined often, your understanding. How else is understanding going to grow? We need to understand our thinking by simply asking a few questions, very fundamental questions. There are not many. One of the questions is there a way at all? A second question, a way toward what? And what is it that I am seeking? Questions that we should have asked at the very beginning of our search. A little late, but better late than never. Huh? Right. Now, I think we have found in our plowing around that in many of the methods that are supposed to lead us toward liberation, we find some inherent contradictions. Some teachers say there is a path, there is a way, along which if you will travel, or cart, donkeyback, or however, if you go step by step, you will achieve the goal. And this implies a gradual acquisition of wisdom. or a gradual acquisition of freedom, or a gradual acquisition of mind. And then we add to this, for myself, for me, I'm going to be free, I'm going to be liberated, and so on. This self, this I, is going to be perfected if I go along this way. And there's a lot of teachers that say that, and there is some validity to it to a certain point. And then there are other teachers who say that reality is no mind. And therefore, if reality is no mind, there is no such thing as self. So now we are faced with this problem, and it's a real problem. Either there is an entity called self that can be enriched and enlarged and perfected or decorated or adorned or what have you, you know. In which case, if there is, I should be very, very busy beautifying this entity in all respects, by whatever method. Rules I should follow, regulations I must follow. Or, on the other hand, there is no such thing at all, and I am only keeping up a ridiculous farce trying to keep an illusory entity alive. One hand or the other hand. So before I get bogged down in a lot of contradictory teachings, the first thing I have to find out, and it is a must, is whether or not there is an everlasting, enduring entity called myself. That's number one on the list. Wouldn't that seem logical to you to find that out first if that's the first problem? It's the first problem. Everything hinges on that. So don't now in your minds with all these thinking parts, you know, jump to a conclusion about what you have either heard or read. Do you really know whether or not there is an enduring entity called myself? It's called I sometimes. Do you really know? And what are you waiting for? And do not accept this concept, and do not reject this concept. What is required to find out is to grasp an understanding of how your mind operates. The mechanism of it, you know? You're to understand the working parts. And in order to do that, you have to go within yourself. After all, that's where your mind is, isn't it? You can't go up to the moon or to the stars or out in the sky someplace looking for this beneficent gentleman. Here, that's where my mind is. And if I got to find out how it works, I got to look at my mind. What could be simpler? So that's the only way to start. You delve into yourself for an answer. And so you begin to look, and you can look with questions, such as, you know, what we did with summer session, looking within and looking without, all is mutable. Nice little statement. looking within, looking without, all is mutable. Also, another question you can ask yourself, is the thinker different from his thought? I mean, we might as just as well start with the very basics, huh? Is the thinker different from his thought? Could it be, as I am looking at all these thoughts going through, could it be that there is something in here like a factory turning out thought sausages? Well, huh? What happens when a thought comes to an end? You know, here you fill up and, you know, you got this nice concept and you set it on a back burner so that when you need it again, you can haul it out and you can again go through this sausage. Yeah? Yeah. What happens when thought comes to an end? You know. What does present say in dreamless sleep? Your thoughts are not there. Mm-hmm. Is the thinker still there? Is the thinker present? You come to an end of a thought in your head. You can practice this all day long. Oh, the rose is red, period. Before I start another thought, there is something, what's present in between that and the next thought? Do you know the difference between a thinker and a thought? Do you know the difference between a thinker and myself, if there is any difference? I mean, do you ask yourself these questions? You know, they're all about you. Thinking, you know, is something like going to a movie. The same mechanism sort of applies of a projection. And there are dozens of individual frames, let's say, of a man walking, you know. And these frames, individual frames, appear on the screen as one continuous integrated movement. Huh? But if we know that they are all frames of different positions, then that projection becomes an optical illusion. Now our eyes are too slow to isolate the separate frames. You know, they're all frames. So we have the impression, and looking out, of continuity. Not seeing how our eyes operate. And so with the thinking, we have these frames of thinking. Can you see them? That's so simple, you know, it's what could be easier than seeing all these frames of thinking? Yeah? But once you can see the frames of thinking, then they are like sausages. You know, it's not so, it doesn't have such a continuity to it. And then you begin to question, does the thinker rise with the thought, or is the thinker already present? Which came first, the thinker or the thought? You know, it's the old chicken and egg thing. Well, let us say, for instance, that we might come to a conclusion that the thinker rises with the thought. This is just for instance that. Thought gives itself continuity, permanency, and security by means of memory. Yeah. Because of memory, we have this seeming continuity of thought, of thinker. And this continuity, you know, there is an entity. There is what we call I, the thinker. All the thoughts, and somehow in there is this I, which is really a pseudo-I. And this thought I tries to work upon another thought. Some idealistic concept, let us say, and it tries to mold the other thought into what I, concept I, want. I am working on another I thought, and working on another thought. And you can see the horrendous confusion that would come about, contradictions. And therefore, one has pain. And we remember the old Zen saying, a knife cannot cut itself. And this is what so many people have been practicing for so many years, for centuries, knives cutting themselves. And of course, without success. So there has been no transformation of mind. Because the mind, then, that we are speaking of is the same, is a, what St. Paul had reference to when he said, let that mind be in you, which was in Christ Jesus. That mind. And you're not going to get it with one thought cutting another thought, trying to, because it can't. So there is, again, an old Zen saying which goes, if you work on your mind with your mind, how can you avoid an immense confusion? Now, we all are aware, I think, we have been told and we have read and we've seen things on the movies, you know, on the TV, that an unexploded mine, you know, somebody has left put a mine someplace, and that's not been detonated. That kind of a mine. Not a mine that you dig into and get gold. An unexploded mine can be dismantled very quickly by somebody who knows about mines. They can dismantle it because they know how it was assembled. Now, this machinery, I, is put together by time, in time. And in time, you want to know what timeless is. In time, you want to know what time is. How can you possibly? That's the knife cutting the knife, isn't it? Or trying to? Yeah. Only when we can consciously take it apart, can we see it for what it is? How we have put it all together unconsciously, and now as we begin to understand it, we can take dismantle it, as it were, and we can find out whether or not there is an enduring entity. Is there or is there not an everlasting enduring entity called myself? No, you know, I'm not saying yes or no. I'm just saying find out. Yeah. Now, the I, this myself, you know, arises about the time when we're three. And it comes about through bodily sensations. A bodily sensation. I'm hungry. Little baby's hungry and yells. Body sensation. And perception. It perceives how its mother operates. It perceives for a long time how mama operates. Finally, when it's about seven, it transfers somewhat over to papa. But in the meanwhile, everything it learns from mama. And its little friends, you know, casually learns from its friends up until that time. Casually learns from papa about that time. But mostly from mama. This I that rises and takes over. And you say it is the thinker. I say it is the thought. This I that rises is not consciousness, no matter how much you wish it were so, it is not consciousness. It is this I, which I say I, is not the I which causes thought and perception. It is the I which is the result thereof. Does that clarify anything for you? Now, this I that has arisen, this pseudo-self, appears very solid, very permanent, entity. And this entity which is formed wants to grasp for me. But at the same time, it wants to be socially accepted. And it is forced to be socially accepted in a covert manner, so that no one, not even this entity, not even itself, myself, sees the intent. Obviously, it must not be obvious. It must be covert. Which in turn gives us a basic conflict. So, and then we have this basic anxiety. One part of us wants to have my way. It grasps and exploits. And then there is the other part that wants respectability, and it wants to conform, or at least have a surface-like appearance of conforming. And this is where we begin really to exploit ourselves. Now, the environment in which we live creates another complication. We live at this time in an environment of personality cult. It is very important to have the right sort of personality. Now, we are aware, I think, most everybody here is, that the word personality comes from the Latin, persona, which means mask, a mask that you sound through. So in time, our masks become more and more and more complicated, and we become more and more and more identified with them, which simply means in the long run, we are not even aware of the masks that we wear. Should really chew on that one for a while. Now, we have a head full of all these whirling thoughts which appear to have a life of their own. And because of all these whirling thoughts, there is no tranquility in us. This ever-circling mind. We look at it, when you can look at these thoughts so objectively that it's like a bunch of monkeys running around in a tree. It's exactly what they look like. You know, they flash around, you know. And that's what you think you're trying to control. First of all, we do have to accept that we have a mind full of whirling thoughts. I mean, you know, let's always begin very simply. The whole thing is really very simple if you would stop looking for the end. We have a head full, a mind full of thoughts, all these moving parts, and each of these thoughts is pivoting around this pseudo-I. And this I, of course, is very concerned with gain and loss. It has all kinds of notions of what is best for itself, And it also has all these troubles of conscience and frustrated pride. And you can see, if you will look at your thoughts, that eventually one or more of these thoughts is going to get the upper hand unless we are continuously on guard, which is an impossibility. So instead of trying to get in there and swim our way through this thing, all these thoughts, let us say, just let the thoughts be. Just let them be. Pay no attention to them. Just let them be. If there's a bunch of monkeys in a tree, there's a bunch of monkeys in a tree. So what? What else? So if we just let the thoughts be, this will allow the mind to unwind itself. If you're going to get in there with them, you know the turmoil you're going to be. So let them be and let them just all unwind. And it slows down. It's amazing how it slows down. So for a little while, then you forget rules and regulations. You know, we've been given an awful lot of rules and regulations in this particular kind of thing. And then you set your life by these rules and regulations. And once you are centered on the rules and the regulations, you forget awareness because you're so busy following the rule. Like the fellow who came, the man, the husband that came home one night. The kitchen was a mess. Broken dishes all over the place. All his crockery all over the place. And he looks at his wife and he says, "What happened?" And she says, "Well, there's something wrong with this cookbook." It says, "An old cup without a handle will do for measuring." It has taken me 11 tries to get a handle off without breaking the cup. That's what you're doing with rules and regulations. So allow to slow down. If you allow it to slow down, it's certainly going to become less complicated. And when the mind is not so complicated, you know, perception is clearer. Perception is deeper. Then we can spot things within ourselves because we're not so entangled in the branches with the monkeys. Now, one of the things, as I've said before, that we do spot is our survival instinct. When we are in danger, there is a sudden secretion of adrenaline, which is a very natural process. It helps us through that particular moment, the adrenaline. Now, civilized man, whenever he gets into an emotional reaction, now also comes the adrenaline secretion because his need for self-assertion is frustrated. See, he's taken it another step. It's no longer the survival of this body, it's the survival of the pseudo-I because he doesn't know what the pseudo-I is. So, this I, this self that you don't even know, you know, it's a thought, and this is what you're going to protect. This unnecessary reaction is one of the causes for psychosomatic illness. The whole system is drenched in adrenaline. And the whole thing, the whole process in us is unconscious. Because we have never recognized this I for the trick that it is. Now, Now, it seems obvious to me, from where I sit, that to unravel ourselves, we must be familiar with ourselves. Now, that should be obvious from where you sit also, huh? We handle ourselves, dismantling ourselves in a manner of speaking, as if we were handling an unexploded mind. We should know, first of all, what is objective self-consciousness? What is this objective mind? This mind that speculates and analyzes and judges and reasons and is concerned with feelings and emotions and opinions. And I could go on and on and on, What is this? Then there is the subconscious, which is principally a storehouse. It's where we store the facts and the figures and the experiences and the fears, and it is that ground which gives the pseudo-I its feeling of continuity, because here's where you store, and so this is the memory, subconscious. We are all very familiar with the subconscious, whether we admit to it or not. It's where our facts and figures are stored. It's our memory. If I say 2 and 2 equals 4, where did I get it? From my memory. That's the subconscious. So it is not far away, and it is not all that mysterious. So you don't have to be afraid of it. Then there is the unconscious, and in some instances they will call it the instinctive mind, or they call it the primal mind. Instincts are concerned with the preservation of the species in general. Instinct, the instinct to survive. But it does find its expression, naturally, as self-preservation. One preserves oneself. One individual is not too terribly concerned with the species. It's self-preservation. And after all, to preserve the self is to preserve the species. Right? Right. Now, in all of the experiments of nature since life crawled out of the sea, all the mutations that have gone on in nature, all the evolution, within nature of the differing states of consciousness, from that life that crawled out of the sea until now, all of these places, conditions, into which nature has pushed herself in order to preserve. Just think of it. There's Carl Sagan. Have you heard Carl Sagan when he does it? His thing? A tremendous picture he gives of the development of nature. Let's not call it the development of man. It's the development of nature and her preservation. Now, we say self-preservation, and we take this whole conglomerate picture, and in one little thing, we look at each other and say, take care of yourself. It's mind-boggling. Take care of yourself. Now, this unconscious or this instinctive also takes care and has control of the motor functions, the heart and the glands and the digestion. That's all the province of the unconscious. Now, the approach to understanding, the intellectual approach to understanding of this unconscious is very limited. So we use inference. We cannot haul the unconscious out of its depths and hold it up here in order to dissect it. That is an impossibility. We can only enter therein. And is there then an I? We can only enter therein, or if we must maintain the status of I, we infer. We make inferences. I won't go into that. However, be careful of what you infer. Your inferences. This unconscious is the door, is the gateway to reality. So go on in. You want to understand? Go in. You got to go in. You can only go in directly. You've got to stop inferring and just enter. Now, to be direct means to drop all the habits of self-interest. Everything that we do for gain and loss of this pseudo-I. Supposing that we did a little practice. Supposing that moment by moment by moment by moment by moment, every second of time, every moment, to be aware of this I, all its activities. Now, not abstractly, but moment by moment by moment. And it's kind of a form of meditation called pratyahara. Maybe if you would do that often enough and long enough, you would get so sick of yourselves. You would finally find out, that you can really dismantle yourself and it's okay. There is nothing, and I mean nothing, that takes the place of knowing oneself. When one knows oneself and is really moment-to-momenting it with oneself, mindfulness is all of a sudden right there. It comes into being spontaneously. This not knowing, how wondrous, how mysterious, not knowing knows. Well, and there is a condition, as I said. One is to be vitally interested without having any motive. You're not going to gain anything. You're not going to lose anything. You are just vitally interested. That's a kind of a scientific type of mind, pragmatic, huh? You're just vitally interested with no motive. And for some people, that's very difficult, huh? It means that one just loves to go into a problem, to resolve the problem, regardless of where it's going to lead. Because you can't know ahead of time what the outcome's going to be. You can speculate about it, and you can try to make it come out your way, but then you've got a motive, right? When you have a motive, there is the gain. And when you have the gain, when you've finally gotten the gain in your little hot hands, why, then you have created an artificial entity that accumulates. Aren't you burdened enough by now? There is another condition. One remains completely subjective in one's observations. Without any wish to change anything one observes. In other words, no judgment. You have no desire to change anything that you see within yourself. And you got to be really quick with this. Because as soon as something pops up its head, right away you're going to change it into something else. Now, may the peace and the power that passeth all understanding hold us and keep us in the love of the Christed consciousness while we are seemingly separate one from another. And I thank you very much.
If you find Lola's talks valuable, more will be posted in weeks to come.